The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name is Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and The Observer. This month's guest is William Gibson, who joins us to talk about his first and most celebrated novel, Neuromancer, which gave us the concept of cyberspace back in the prehistory of 1984. Book Club host John Mullen began by asking him whether, when he set out, he was aware of creating a fictional world full of things we would one day need to find names for in reality.
I think I was mainly concerned with finding what I thought of as an arena. A lot of the science fiction I'd read when I was younger, the arena was outer space and space travel. And for various reasons, I knew that that wasn't going to work for me. The other arenas of that sort in science fiction were things like the post-nuclear wasteland, and I didn't want to do that because it was best saved for very young men with very little life experience who can write remarkably well about post-nuclear wasteland. So I was stuck, and stuck for an arena, and where cyberspace came from, it came from walking past, this was well before, I had never seen a personal computer. As far as I know, no one had one except one man who had the American version of the little Sinclair that looked like a TV cable box and had a piece of tape on top that was the keyboard. And he had attached it to an old television set and was teaching it to do something very laboriously by typing on the piece of tape. Right. So I was familiar with the concept of a personal computer, but they weren't out and about in the world. And I didn't play the primitive video games of the day, but when I would walk past a video arcade, I'd glance in and I'd always notice the body language of the kids who were playing the games. And it struck me how incredibly physical that language was. And I felt that there was a yearning that had they been able to, they would reach through the glass and manipulate the incredibly big clunky pixels of their game to win. They were absolutely focused. And it struck me that they were focused on a sort of notional space behind the screen. So I had that idea, and one day I was walking past the bus stop and I saw an Apple ad for the Apple IIc, which looked something like a little briefcase or a typewriter when without its little television set attached to it. And there was a businessman's beautifully cuffed arm holding an Apple IIc, and it was about this big. And I thought, well, if that's a computer and each of those has a screen, anywhere in the world they might be, what if there was a common notional space behind all those screens? And that was it. That was the eureka moment. And except that it didn't strike me as being that remarkable. And so I immediately assumed that anyone who knew more about this emergent technology than I did had already thought of it. So I'd better go home and get it in a story. as soon as I could. So I had that ready when I began Neuromancer as the arena that would replace space and the some sort of personal computer as the vehicle that would replace the spaceships. So, and that was really, at the beginning of the project, that was really all I had.
So one of the striking things about the future world in the novel is that, like quite a lot of things actually, we have to find out about it as we go along, almost by accident sometimes, about where we are, when it is, what's happened.
Yeah.
You find out lots of little bits of history. So there's been a war. You don't want to go to Bonn, it's radioactive. You know, that there's been a war against Russia. Did you have an imagined history that you were just going to hint at, or were you not very interested in that?
No, I was hinting at an imaginary history that didn't exist beyond the hints. I was more concerned with the order and sequence of the hints, and I didn't want it to be devoid of all exposition, and which would leave it totally confusing and chaotic. But I wanted the expedition to work fractally, but in a carefully conceived sequence. I wanted to initially cause the reader to feel that they were a stranger in a strange land, but I wanted the narrative to educate them as they continued without really seeming to do so. So with paying sufficient attention, the reader's knowledge of the milieu increases exponentially, or should. That was the plan.
Because I think when I first read the novel 20 years ago or more, I had that experience of trying to work it out and of being kind of guided in a way by what you'd given me into doing so. Now, I'm afraid now, of course, rereading it, if I forget what a Hiroko is, I Google it, and there are great William Gibson kind of lexicons and glossaries.
That's
which
true.
Kind of,
that's
it
true.
Seems a pity almost. What do you feel? I mean, do you think...
It's different. David Simon, the creator of The Wire, was criticized a few years ago for the lack of exposition in another series of his. And he just said, there's Google. And I thought, well, there is. But it does take away... It doesn't take away the tennis, but it takes away the net.
yeah. I mean, it's also, I remember once doing an interview with Ian Banks about his science fiction, and I said it must give you great pleasure to see kind of people doing such justice to the texture and complication of the world you created. And he said, no, because people keep picking up on contradictions, which otherwise readers wouldn't have noticed. Does it place a sort of a new kind of pressure to make any world that you invent consistent so that the William Gibson aficionados out there are going to be able to gloss it properly?
It does to some extent, although I try to ignore it. Probably at my peril. I just in the last 24 hours, I saw that someone was pointing out a mischosen word in the peripheral, and I haven't had the heart to look it up. Although I think they're probably right.
And you say it's written from. It's written in a third person from a point of view of Case, main character. But of course, one of the main technological things, conceptual things you do, is you make it a story where there's a device which enables him almost to experience things from another person's point of view, which is a kind of, if George Eliot had that, it would have been fantastic for her.
Well, that's an interesting, thereby hangs a tale in that the SimStim simulated stimuli technology that Case uses came from my very first short story. It was really my very first work of completed fiction, and I invented that technology or something very similar to it because, like many first-time writers, I found myself unable to get characters in and out of a room. So I invented this gadget that would allow me to jump cut experience and built the story around that so that I really developed this imaginary technology to work my way around a really fundamental lack of narrative skill. Quite a bit, in my opinion, even at that, you wouldn't have been able to get me to admit it on publication, but I think it's safe to say now that quite a bit of the more interesting ways in which Neuromancer is structured aren't about my avant-garde sensibility. It's about these very fundamental skills I lacked that had to become very adroit in hiding with these imaginary techno gizmos.
And you also, it seems like the protagonist also comes from somewhere else as well, but he comes out of detective fiction, or there's a kind of tone to it, which I think I'm certainly not the first to detect, amongst the sometimes mysterious diction of an imaginary technology. There's a kind of hard-boiled detective thing going on as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. There's kind of more Jim Thompson than Raymond Chandler, and for that matter, more Dashiell Hammett than Raymond Chandler. But he was also weirdly, and this I think this is probably, whenever I say this, I think there are people who wince and turn away. Case was influenced by Springsteen's album Nebraska, which is a very, very noir, hyper-American album about quasi-criminal hot rod racers racing back and forth across the United States. And when I first listened to it, as I often did in those days when listening to pop music, I tried to imagine what a work of science fiction would be like if it had something very close to that sensibility. And when I tried to imagine that, I couldn't think of any science fiction I'd ever read that quite went in that direction.
And in the last part of the novel, when we get to this kind of weird, half-cloned, half-cryogenically preserved family in Switzerland. And, I mean, it's like a kind of Raymond Chandler, isn't it? It's like a kind of Raymond, one of those families that Philip Marlowe walks into.
It is a bit. Tessier Ashpool's, they're a bit like Gormenghast. And sort of a mini Gormenghast plugged onto the end of an orbital Las Vegas.
And were you hoping that you'd have readers who'd recognize and delight in those different elements, then?
Well, I think I had to assume, as one does, that there could be an optimal reader somewhere who would catch each reference and nuance, but in practice, I think it would be fairly unlikely. What I did suspect, and I think that this is true, is that the resonances in popular culture would be there. That something would. It's not so much that I'm would be, it isn't so much that I was expecting people to recognize the references, but I was expecting different parts of their brains to light up slightly in response to something they already knew from elsewhere. Yeah.
My happiest little moment was when we meet Neuromancer, and he quotes W.H. Auden.
Yes.
But without a footnote, so yes. I felt really cool to have recognized it. I'm sure I missed all the Bruce Springsteen, but I got that one, and I was very grateful for it. That brings me on to the next question, because that's in a chapter where something happens which seems to be, it's quite an important chapter late on in the book, which seems to indicate quite a challenge you set yourself with your method. I mean, you talked earlier I don't think anybody quite believed you that you invented the devices to get around narrative problems, but the SimStim business is really narratively useful. The artificial intelligences in the novel, I don't know, they seem to give a novelist a problem in that they're so powerful that there's a risk that maybe the characters are robbed not just of sort of agency and power, but actually of any kind of reality at all. So there's a chapter where Case actually meets a former lover who, in a kind of conventional narrative sense, is dead. Mm-hmm. But then she's not dead. She's in some imaginary way. Her consciousness is brought alive again, and there are images to go with that. And it's a kind of, it's kind of temptation scene almost. Mm-hmm. You can kind of have a lovely time on the beach with somebody, a past lover who's not dead at all. Did you feel the sort of challenge of kind of where do you stop doing that? That if these AIs in the novel are so powerful, what room does it leave for human beings to make decisions?
I did, actually. And all I can say is that you can see, you can see exactly how I ultimately played it. It became the text of the book. There is, although I couldn't explain exactly how one does it, a way or ways in which it's possible to limit the play and keep it. If it had gone further into the virtual, the story would have evaporated. So that each time he has a cyber Faustian moment, something rips him back to the physical. There's something urgently required in meat space, thank you. And he has to go and do it. There is, of course, a level at which that doesn't really make sense. But when you're driving the narrative to what you hope will be its inevitable conclusion, whatever that might be, and I had no idea, you can't afford to stop. A big part of the job is simply getting through to what seems to be the end without breaking the frame too obviously.
Well, I want to ask about the inevitable conclusion in a second. But just before that, Case, he makes love with his former lover who's brought back to kind of virtual life in this kind of delicious spot. You give him quite a peculiar attitude, which is at one with his enthusiasm for cyberspace, to what he calls meat. Yeah, he calls meat. Anything fleshly is meat. And this is in a world where, lots of people's bodies are variously artificially enhanced or repaired or simply transformed. And you can't tell what people look like sometimes because they can get a transformation. And it seems quite important in the novel that he has this, cyberspace is what he called bodiless exaltation. And everything fleshly is sort of in his mind corrupting or base or something like that. Is that right? Is that important to the novel?
I think that his attitude to the corporeal has more to do with his personal need for the exceptional agency that he previously possessed in cyberspace, and to whatever extent I felt I understood him as a character, I think I assumed that he wasn't being honest with himself, that he can't afford to accept his own emotions, which arise, in my understanding, from his corporeal being. So what he tells himself he's yearning for is a kind of neon Aristotelian uber realm. And yeah, sure, but he doesn't feel very good about one thing and another. He doesn't like it that Linda's dead and that it's his fault. And he can't face those things. And his moment of heroic transcendence in the narrative, in which he sort of finds his superpower again. The text literally says he came in steep, fueled by self-loathing. It's like he wins because he recognizes what a shit he is. And then it sort of straightens out into the end, however that goes.
Well, maybe I can ask you about the end, because we're allowed to talk about the end, I'm afraid. So I hope this is not a big down for anybody here. And how the novel ends. And you were saying that you seemed to imply that you weren't, when you started the novel, you weren't entirely certain how it was going to end. Or that you had to, did you change your mind at all about how it was going to end?
No, I had literally no idea. I knew that this was a commissioned work. It wasn't on spec. I was given an advance, which is very unusual for a first novel, and it was for a series of first novels that the late Terry Carr commissioned. And it was his second series of what he called his Ace SF specials. And he had some taste, and he discovered people. Kim Stanley Robinson was one, and Michael Swanwick both published first novels in the series with Neuromancer. And he made me this offer, which I couldn't refuse, and I said, oh, sure, yeah. And I, went home and had a nervous breakdown because I knew that I had no idea how to write a novel, and in my own scale of things, I assumed it was going to take a decade or so of writing short fiction before I'd be ready to attempt one. And now I had to write one, and I had 12 months in which to do it, and I wound up going 6 months over, thereby technically voiding the contract. That was anxiety-producing. And not the first time I've voided one by going over. And, well, actually, it was the first time.
It was not a precedent.
Not the last time. But I really had no idea. I had to get started. I decided that I needed some sort of very primitive, highly workable narrative armature, so that I knew I had all this cyberspace stuff that was whirling around that I could do, and I knew I could sort of come up with a whole bunch of weird to dress the narrative up, but I thought I need something that I can shove through this thing like a wire coat hanger through a bunch of cotton candy. And that was the heist story. It's a caper story. They hire this guy to steal something from some very scary bad guys. And it's all built around that. And its conclusion wasn't of much, actually of very much concern to me. I wanted it to start and I wanted it to have narrative traction, and I would worry about that conclusion thing when I got there. And when I got there, that was really a problem. But I learned that it could be worked out, and it could be accommodated with what Bruce Sterling calls backfill, where you can go back to the front end of the book and build in the bits you need to cause the end to go the way it's chosen to go as you wrote it. So not rocket science in the plotting department.
And would it be wrong to think, I mean, we get these two AIs which get their consummation devoutly to be wished, and a couple of pages from the end, we get told, but I mean, Case is thinking this, what these entities are. Wintermute was hive mind, decision maker, affecting change in the world outside. Neuromancer was personality. Neuromancer was immortality. I mean, it feels a little bit as though you're getting to the end of the narrative, because those are also sort of metaphors suddenly for human inclinations rather than actually any longer names for sort of technological entities.
It's actually very close to being out of character for Case to think that area of the book in which the voice of the novel overlaps Case's character. There are going to be some funny transactions with the reader going on now. And really, well, I think what you're getting in that passage you just read is the author of the book, it wasn't time to like fully drop it. And knowing that the reader would want some closure and patching it with a piece of language. And that's because in the weird fluid business of closure in a novel, you can do that with language. And one thing I discovered while writing this book is that if you're really, really stuck, it's really going pear-shaped, extremely heightened language can really help. And I haven't ever looked at it that way. I'm inclined to think that Neuromancer's most heightened flights of language probably reflect moments of structural panic on the author's part.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
I think it's time for you all to get a chance. We've got some roving microphones.
Yeah, so one of the things that strikes me as really innovative about Neuromancer, and indeed about a lot of your work, is the kind of socioeconomic structures that are come into play into the plot. And I was wondering if you could just sort of talk a little bit more about sort of the big conglomerates and how they really shape the characters' sort of lives and plots, and where the inspiration for that came from.
In my first year as an undergraduate and as a mature student, I don't know what course it was that required me to attend this lecture, but I probably Anthropology 101, which I got quite a lot of good stuff out of. And I went to a lecture by a visiting professor from the United States, and she lectured on multinational corporations. And she began by positing a scenario in which an alien but completely non-human race discovered Earth and had no way, the alien race was trying to figure out what the dominant life form was on Earth right then. And this would have been in 1977 that I heard this lecture. And she said, "What do you think?" And, you know, people said, "Humans, nation states," and, you know. And she said, "Multinational corporations." And she had a very compelling argument for why a truly alien race could regard multinational corporations as the dominant life form on the planet. They're effectively immortal. They're not dependent on this physical survival of any of the human beings who make them up. She said they're like slime mold. It doesn't matter who dies. They keep going. They straddle nation states. World War II comes and the Shell splits into two corporations, or Coca-Cola splits into two corporations and continues doing business on both sides. Flows seamlessly back together after hostilities cease. But it was a much more developed argument than that. And I'd never even heard the term multinational corporations. So it immediately went into what would become my hopper for writing science fiction. And the other thing I can say about it's that the science fiction I grew up reading, most of it had no socioeconomic realism whatever. None. It had none at all. That wasn't what it was for. There had been in the United States a sort of left-leaning, slightly Marxist-tinged school of science fiction, particularly after World War II, that I had particularly enjoyed, but without really understanding what it was that I enjoyed about it. I think that the pre-Marxist science fiction ultimately found its truest expression in very generic fantasy stories in which, as Michael Moorcock once said, everybody in the tavern has a pint of ale, but nobody ever pays for one. And nobody ever has a job to get the gold to pay for one. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something. I wanted a kind of science fiction that was more naturalistic and that took things like socioeconomics less for granted.
So many of your subsequent books have been set here, and I wanted to know what it is that draws you to London in particular.
London became, it was an accident of publication. In the United States, Neuromancer was published as a paperback original. I hadn't expected it to be reprinted. I thought it would appear as a paperback original, go out of print, and that would be that. And one day, 20 years on, my dream of literary success was that people in London or perhaps Paris would discover this old yellowing paperback and say, "Ah, a late Alfred Bester imitator. This is some cool. This is some cool shit." But in Great Britain, it was picked up by Victor Golantz, who used to be in Henrietta Street below Covent Garden and had once been Orwell's publisher. And it was published in hardcovers, which is why the Golantz hardcover Neuromancer is now worth like $2,000 a pop or something, because that's the true hardcover first edition of of Neuromancer, and they didn't make too many, and I wish I'd gotten a few more. So that caused London to become the foreign city, including New York, that I visited most frequently in my career as a writer. I glimpsed it and thought, wow, that's some crazy city. And so when I had repeated opportunities, for every time I'd publish a book, I'd come back. And so I not only got to know it a bit, but I got to see it change. And so that's continued. I find it so much richer to come back to a place I've learned to know than to go to a new place. And maybe it's a failing in my personality, but the depth of the experience is so different. This is the only foreign country that I feel I know well enough to render in semi-unembarrassing terms in fiction.
Hello. I was lucky enough to read Neuromancer when I was about 19 in 84. And one of the things that really resonated with me was the depiction of Case as a drug addict, basically. He's a speed freak, as I was at the time myself. And to me, it was very well written. There's a lot in there that I thought, well, that's really accurate. That's the way it is. I was wondering, was that something you'd witnessed in those around you, or is it just a plot technique or for the structure?
I would have been very unhappy with rendering it non-realistically. And somewhat in the way that I would be unhappy with technical description of firearms. I needed Case to have a drug problem. I don't think it actually makes much historical sense, particularly now, for Case to have been addicted to such an incredibly primitive drug. He was addicted to something that I think was discovered in the 1920s. And if someone writing Neuromancer today, if Neuromancer hadn't been written, he would have been addicted to something more high-tech. But it was that the amphetamines were a trade-off with I wanted the book to resonate with known street dirt and not to be entirely high-tech imaginary stuff. So I could have, I had the choice of giving him a blankety blank habit, and blankety blank would have been a whole page of delirious writing about some non-existent futuristic drug, but I thought that would weaken it. So I took him to like Kmart cocaine. I took him to like the very bottom of the barrel in illicit stimulants. And I did it for stylistic reasons, but in stylistic reasons in terms of set dressing. And I did it as clinically accurately as I was able to.
I've always wondered why in Neuromancer there wasn't more reference to organized religion. I always imagined a dystopian future these days would be hard to imagine without the evangelical churches or other such organizations.
I wasn't doing, had I been doing the Borgesian encyclopedia version, there might be evangelical religions. I eventually got around to evangelical religions in the sequels and in subsequent novels, and indeed there's a really nasty one in the Peripheral. But it didn't seem to be. I think it's actually, to some extent, it's a function of viewpoint character. And Case is the only viewpoint character in Neuromancer, which is unusual for me. I've only done that in one other book. I eventually became more at home with alternating points of view, but Case is all you get. And I think it would be out of character for Case to have given a shit about organized religion. He doesn't think that way. Neither do you see anything in Neuromancer of what the middle class in this world must be like. I never assumed that everyone in the world except these rich people are like Molly and Case. They're obviously of a criminal, kind of weirdly neo-Victorian, actually, criminal milieu. And there are sort of hints that they're normal people out there, but we don't care about them. The narrative doesn't care about them. That's not what it's doing.
I was wondering what the inspiration was for the Turing police, as they seem almost the opposite of what the rest of the book's about.
I don't remember exactly what that is. I thought that it was a good time for there to be an incursion from the straight world. Bruce Sterling once described Peter Riviera in Neuromancer as being a character whose sole purpose is to distract the reader from what hideous people the protagonists are. And in that light, I think that the Turing police are what the character in Repo Man calls normal fucking people. And there's an incursion of them into Case's life, and then they're chopped to ribbons a few pages later. And I think that that's really their function. They sort of come in and say, Case, you've been very, very bad. And then some kind of gardening robot is taken over and nips them into tiny bits. And that's all you get to see of them.
Since Neuromancer, a lot of your work's been focused in the near future. And I was wondering if you could talk about the difference between your approaches to the near future and like big ideas and far future, and if you feel like you'd probably do something that's kind of set like way in the future again.
Well, there's a progress, if you can call it that, in my body of work. Neuromancer and its two related non-sequels were all set in what is, from internal evidence, probably the mid to late 2030s. And then another three-volume, but not a trilogy set, which began with Virtual Light. Those books were set about now in what I suppose has thereby become a sort of alternate history. When I wrote them in the 90s, they were the very near future. When I finished the last of those, All Tomorrow's Parties, I had an uneasy feeling that my sense of how weird the world was at the time I wrote All Tomorrow's Parties was maybe getting a bit long in the tooth, so that yardstick of weirdness felt a bit short for the day. And there's a sort of calculation I have to be able to make instinctively between the weirdness of the day and the weirdness of my imagined future. So to recalibrate the yardstick, I wrote three more books, which I thought of as speculative novels of the very recent past, in that they were each set in the year in which they were written, which would be the year before each one was published. And that began with Pattern Recognition. And having completed that project, the only thing I could do to test the resulting yardstick was to write a novel set in an imaginary future, which became The Peripheral, which is in some ways set in two imaginary futures, actually to better test the yardstick. And the Peripheral feels to me as though it's actually the sequel to the Big End books, if that makes any sense. It's the world that results from the world of the Big End books, which unfortunately is ours, or was a few years ago.
Wait, I think we got time for
Can
one.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes. Where?
I read that you went to university at one point, and that you took a course, or you were forced to take a course in literature, which I assume is the great canon of modern or ancient or whatever. And I'm just wondering if there was any books, writers, who you particularly admired and enjoyed.
Well, I got I was an English honors student, and I got a bachelor's degree, and I specialized to the extent that I specialized in anything in literary critical methodology. And looking back, I think that the single work I read that had the most influence on me as a writer was E.M. Forster's Aspects of the Novel. And my two takeaways from that were that didacticism on the author's part disastrously lowers the tone, and that, as this is kind of a very rough quote, as Forster said, a writer fully in control of her characters is not doing the work. And that really impressed me because I didn't get it. How could that be? I'd never written anything. So over the course of my career as a writer of fiction, I think I've gradually come to experience some of what Forster was talking about, which is not the same as the book writing itself, but is the experience of, should I be so unwise as to make an executive decision as the author of the book? The protagonist downs tools and won't move until I've rescinded that decision and allowed her to go in some other direction, which is a eerie and wonderful sensation when she does indeed go in another direction, and it's as though the thing one is building is steering itself. And so those are like reading Forster was really, really important to me. The other thing was seeing Chris Marker's short film La Jetée in a film history course. And if I hadn't seen that, I might well not be here tonight.
I know there are lots more questions, but we have to release William at some stage. And I just wanted to thank you all for your questions and your expertise. And I'm sure you want me to thank William for answering your questions so generously.
And that's it from our final book club of 2014. Next week, we'll start a daily Christmas series of digested reads, rounding up and cutting down to size some of the big books of the year. Until then, from John Mullen, me, Claire Armistead, and producer Eva Krishak, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.